This is Climate One, changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. On today's program, flipping the switch on America's road trip.
I mean, once you get into an electric vehicle and it's smooth and it's quiet and it's fast, you don't want to actually go back into a gasoline vehicle.
The future of the planet depends on ending our fossil fuel addiction, and it is happening. Sales of electric vehicles are increasing, and self-driving cars are right around the corner. But making a successful transition to plug-ins means getting everybody on board.
This is not about finger-pointing. You know, the customer needs to be integrated, the regulator, the policymaker, the industry, and also the energy colleagues, let it be utilities or let it be fossil.
Power shift, the end of gasoline cars, up next on Climate One. Is the age of the gas guzzler coming to an end? Welcome to Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. Climate One conversations with oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, are recorded before a live audience and hosted by Greg Dalton. After more than a century of ruling the roads, oil is starting to lose its dominance over the auto industry. More and more automakers are introducing electric models, and according to one report, sales of electric cars will surpass those of regular cars within 25 years. On today's program, we'll explore the future of the cars we love, the impact of robotic and electric vehicles, and the changing nature of how we get around town. Our guests represent the electric power industry, fossil fuel producers, and a leading automaker that has already made the leap into electric cars. Caroline Choi is Senior Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at Southern California Edison. Kathy Rehise-Boyd is President of the Western States Petroleum Association, and Andreas Klugescheid is Head of External Affairs for the BMW Group. Now, our conversation about the future of personal mobility. Here's Greg Dalton.
Kathy Rehise-Boyd, let's start with China. Fortune reported recently that China has a timetable for ending production and sale of cars running on fossil fuels in the next couple of decades. That could reshape the global auto industry. How do you think that's going to shake out?
Thank you, Greg, and thank you for having us all here and at the Commonwealth Club. So when we think about this issue as the oil and gas industry, We really want to understand how these conversations impact some really important things, because I think it will drive sort of a shared vision that we have for the sustainable energy future, if you might, in this kind of low carbon economy. And one of the things we ask ourselves is, what is the type of energy mix that will give us the most affordable energy to the most people? What is the type of energy mix that will deliver the best air quality improvements or climate change reductions of greenhouse gases? What are the best energy mix that will really talk about the economic side of the equation for upward mobility of people who certainly work in our industry and many who engage, obviously, in the issue of transportation fuels? And then lastly, how do those three things mix together as we really plan for the future? How do they interact with one another? What is the right combination? I was speaking at the Verde Exchange, and one of the issues was natural gas. And the only comment I made relative to your question, Greg, is, you know, we're in each other's swim lanes now. Like, I know Caroline, I know Andreas, we've interacted for many, many years. In the past, we did transportation fuels. Edison did electricity. Autos kind of mixed with the two of us. How are we going to have a car and a fuel that, like, works together? And so now we're all over each other's swim lanes. You know, I have companies who invest in electric charging stations. I have companies who are trying to make the cleanest biodiesel or renewable diesel or renewable natural gas. I have companies who are trying to make, you know, the best low-carbon ethanol for liquid fuels. So it's just, we use electricity, we produce electricity because we provide natural gas. We're all over each other's swim lanes. And I personally think that's exciting. I think that's going to deliver really the best answer to our shared vision of where we all go.
So there's, yeah, entrance, electricity coming into oil, electricity mixing in ways they didn't in the past. But on China saying they want to end the age of gasoline cars, China is, you know, certainly rising in the global economy in terms of auto industry manufacturing, and they have the ability to do things a little more simply and cleanly than the U.S. federal government does. So when China says they want to end the age of oil, what does that mean for oil companies?
Well, put it in context to California's aggressive environmental leadership in this area. Certainly, the state of California has made it very clear on what their goals are for electric vehicles and for the transition. But when you step back and say, okay, what does that actually mean to all of us in a, sort of an inclusive conversation about this? We've got 26 million vehicles, internal combustion engines, in the state of California. We have 340,000 electric vehicles. I could say last time I spoke here, we had 200,000 electric vehicles. So electric vehicle penetration is increasing, and that's, you know, that mix and that conversation is exciting. But in the context of how long, and to China making that statement, when you put it in the context of like a place like California, we're the third largest consumer of transportation fuels in the world as a state. And the only two that are in front of us is China and the United States of America. So the challenge of what goes behind that statement from China is huge when you just bring it back and put it in the context of California and what that's going to look like in the time and the transition, the conversation about what that really means.
Well, Andreas Klugeschard with BMW, when you look at China making a statement like that, also Britain, UK, India and France have done similar things, do you say, oh, those are politicians making promises they won't be around to keep? Or does that make you sit up and think, oh, something's going on?
Well, in case of China, I'm not even sure if they are actually out there long enough to see the fulfillment of whatever plans they have for the next decades to come, because they tend to stay a little bit longer, Chinese politicians. But anyway, you know, in car business being a global business, you cannot ignore, nor can you, don't care about what politicians actually do and say. It is framing to a larger degree and ever larger degree our products and with that our strategies. So in other words, yes, we are aware, obviously, of what the politicians say and then what plans they have. But for the time being, I share Kathy's view that the internal combustion engine and with that to some degree also the fossil fuel portion of the fuel equation is going to be out there for a long while. And the question is how to shape that transformation to a decarbonized transportation system in parallel. So you will have to do both. And we do both, actually. You know, we are, for example, in Europe, by far the market leader in selling electrified vehicles with BMW. Nobody is selling more electrified vehicles than we do. But on the other hand, if you look into the numbers, we are probably selling around 2.5 million cars per year, roughly. And, you know, our next target for 2019 is to do around 140,000 electrics. So that is still a smaller portion, by far, actually, a smaller portion compared to the internal combustion engine car. And what we see is, yes, there are more cars coming to the road, and it's actually accelerating rapidly when it comes to electric vehicles. But there is still the task to make conventional cars more and more efficient, and that also absorbs, obviously, money, investments, and energy.
Caroline Choi, we had on this stage the mayors of Houston and Miami who've suffered tremendous pain in their cities and talking about a faster transition away from fossil fuels because they're paying the very real price, tens of billions of dollars of storms that were amplified, not caused by. And we all saw the devastation that Harvey and Irma caused. So I think you all agree on the direction. Let's talk about the pace. You know, is this happening fast enough to decarbonize the transportation sector? The scientists would say it's got to happen faster.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, we certainly agree that it has to happen. I mean, we have very ambitious goals here in California, right? So the 2030 carbon goal to get there 40% below 1999 levels by 2030. The pathway that we put forward in October talks about 7 million electric vehicles in California by that date. So 12 years to get to 7 million when we're at 340,000. So it's a very ambitious climb to get to that number. The governor just put out 5 million, you know, in his State of the State and through an executive order. So, and that only represents about 24% of passenger vehicles at that time, projected at that time. So still a lot of headroom in the internal combustion engine space, even with 7 million vehicles in California at that time. So a lot of room to go, but I think we have to get started, and there has to be more activity and momentum behind getting there. And I think it is doable. We talked about just, you know, in the back room there about how quickly the internal combustion engine took over horse-drawn carriages. And so I think with more models coming, with affordability, the pricing coming down to a degree that more people can get into those cars, more used vehicles in the marketplace for people to try them out and test, awareness growing, and then the accessibility of charging increasing with various programs, I think we'll see adoption hopefully leaping forward.
Well, tell us about, you went to, I think it was a car show or convention recently, and you went around and you talked to different car makers, Caroline Choi, and General Motors was talking about having electric options for all their models by 2022.
Yeah.
All the others were saying that by 2025, which is a curious time frame. So tell us about that experience, about the different aggression you see on going electric.
Yeah, well, I think the timing was somewhat interesting, only that in that the federal government is looking right now at the standards that it has in place for the model 2022 to 25 vehicles, the fleet and the emission standards that are appropriate for those vehicles, and in time to give the automakers time to plan and design and build those cars. So it was just interesting that GM was on the early side of that time frame, and all the other automakers seem to be on the later side of that time frame. But I do think it's will be happening, and what I do see is the acceleration of announcements by automakers to move into more electrified vehicles, to either transition to have an electrified version of every passenger vehicle that they sell, or significant portion of their offering to have an electrified version, which I think is great.
Andreas Klugeschardt, tell us about, there's so much hype and excitement and a little bit of fear about robotic, autonomous, we're not even sure what labels for these cars. Lots of acronyms out there. We see them daily here in San Francisco, Pittsburgh, other cities. What's the connection between robotic cars and electrification? Do they have to go hand in hand? What's the relationship?
Well, you know, we put what will happen in the next few years in an acronym that is called ACES, and that stands for Autonomous, Connected, Electrified, and Shared. So these four elements will be an integral part of what our future products will encompass. And when you think about autonomous driving, everybody assumes that this will be, to a large degree, electrified. Because, you know, when you think about the potential of a very convenient mobility, then with that goes the necessity to decarbonize that mobility to a larger degree. And, you know, what we also see to some degree is a parallel development. The autonomous vehicle and the electric vehicle will, you know, see larger portions of market penetrations probably around the mid-20s, so 2025, you mentioned that. And so it's a no-brainer to some degree to think about these developments in combination.
Though a lot of the cars so far, a lot of them, the pilots out there, are still running around on gasoline. Kathy Rehaus-Boyd, how do you see that the robots out there and the auto companies saying, well, it makes more sense to have them be electric for many reasons. How does that sit for you in terms of looking at the future demand for oil?
I'm still trying to get my mind around a car without a driver. But but I would say, and I just wanted to mention too, on the liquid fuel side, because as Andreas said, we will have the internal combustion engine for quite some time. And not to say that there's so much we can do on the liquid fuel side. And I reflect back to where we've come, you know, in many conversations we've had, Greg, where we used to have lead in gasoline, right? We took that out. We used to have, I remember the days when EPA launched the ultra-low sulfur diesel, where, you know, we went throughout the state and we held the hanky at the back end of the bus to show it that, you know, wow, this is such a cleaner technology. So now we're in the space of what do you do with liquid fuels to make them less carbon intensive? And on the diesel side, there's a lot that can be done on biodiesel and renewable. On the gasoline side, it's a little tougher because many people probably I have a comprehension of what's known as the blend wall. You can only put 10% of ethanol into gasoline. So the type of ethanol, whether it's corn or sugarcane or what have you, is really important because you can't go above 10. So it's a harder nut to crack as we're in this transition period of what does that look like.
Let me ask you about that, because there's a law in California called, in other states, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which says you got to reduce the carbon intensity of fuels 10% and figure out however you want to do it. And oil companies have litigated against that law at a 10% reduction. Meanwhile, Andreas and BMW and other car makers have committed to 100% increase in the efficiency of the vehicles they make over a period of 15 years or so. So if auto companies can do 100, why is it so hard for oil to do 10?
And part of it, you know, and we're very supportive of the CAFE standards. I mean, as an industry, we understand efficiencies of cars are a very good thing for us to, it's one of the most cost-effective things that can be done. But on the gasoline side, it's a technology issue. So even though we've made strides on the gasoline side with ethanol, we all hoped that cellulosic ethanol would be the big breakthrough because it's a lower carbon intensity. Nobody's been able to quite crack that nut yet. And so it makes gasoline a little more challenging when you have this 10%. Why is there a 10% blend wall, as Andreas can talk about? If you go above that, there's some damage to the engine. So you can't, the relationship of that in an engine, you can't really have any more than 10%. And so it's the type, in the low carbon fuel standard, to your question, Greg, it's the type of ethanol you put in there. So when you think about, well, why don't we just put sugarcane ethanol in all of it? Well, then it's...
That's what happens in Brazil. Right.
But the volume side is an interesting equation. Is there enough sugarcane ethanol to blend in every gallon of gasoline in the state of California when it's 2 million gallons of gasoline and diesel every hour of every day? That's a lot of ship transportation of corn-based ethanol and emissions associated with ships.
Let's ask Andreas. I thought there's E85 that, you know, it's $100. Cars can be retrofitted or changed to, the engines can run on high percentages of biofuels. Is that correct, Andreas?
Well, you know, the typical answer of a car manufacturer to that is, it depends, right? And I'm probably not engineer enough to actually dig into the details of that conversation. But what I can tell you, and I think that is the important bit here, we need to think about a variety of solutions when it comes to that point. And Kathy knows very well that we at BMW, we are pretty supportive of the low carbon fuel standard. Because we think it is necessary that, you know, all stakeholders in that equation do their bit in order to come to the ultimate goal of decarbonization. But as we car manufacturers can actually vouch to it, it's not only the low carbon fuel standard, it's also about hydrogen as a fuel. Mm-hmm. That again, then, you know, hydrogen not being a fuel technically, but an energy carrier. So it depends on how you do that, right? It is about electricity, and again here, you know, the question of what is behind the plug, really, you know, the upstream is a decisive question, and so on and so on. And, you know, it means that car manufacturers currently are putting their money on several bets. You know, it's a period of time that we witness right now where we actually have to distribute our investments to many, many technologies. And on the other hand, the good news is really that many options are out there to actually contribute to that goal, and we need to take whatever we can get in order to bring the carbon emissions down.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about making the switch to electric cars. Coming up, what becomes of big oil?
I think it's very important in any conversation about the energy mix that we are inclusive in that conversation. And I think we will be an important part of that conversation, not only in the past, but going forward.
Continue now with Climate One. Greg Dalton is talking about the end of oil and the electrification of transportation. His guests are Andreas Klugescheid of BMW, Kathy Rehise-Boyd of the Western States Petroleum Association, and Caroline Choi of Southern California Edison. Here's Greg Dalton.
Caroline Choi, some people think that concern that when they buy an electric car, depending on where they live in the world and in the United States, it runs on coal, and coal is dirty. So tell us about the coal connection in electric cars, because where you live matters a lot and how clean your electric car is going to be.
It does. It does matter. But it was interesting. I just was at BNEF, their mobility summit, last week, and they were talking about this exact subject. And the analysis they've done shows that it doesn't matter, even if it's coal power, that you do still see a cleaner vehicle from a non-emission vehicle, because on the coal side, you have controls to try and minimize the emissions coming out of the coal fleet. In California, that's not as much of an issue. We don't have coal in our generation mix, and neither does PG&E and a number of the other utilities, and coal is getting faded out of the California generation mix. So I do think it does matter, as Andrea said, what is behind the plug and what is powering that electricity. Here in California, we already have a 50% renewable portfolio standard that I think we're going to easily achieve, and we do anticipate legislation that is going to increase that standard. So the grid is going to get increasingly cleaner and cleaner, and so we should leverage that grid that's ubiquitous everywhere for more aspects of the economy, like vehicles. So plugging in should be fairly easy because the grid is there. We just have to add charging stations in more places so that people have that availability, whether they're in an apartment building or a condo or a home or a business, that those charging is available for people so they can feel comfortable getting into an electric vehicle and not feeling that they may be stranded without access to a plug.
I think, Greg, one of the other issues just to touch on is the role the consumer plays in all of this, because as we're talking about what that right energy mix, one of the things I talked about in the beginning was the economic side of that equation, because the policies that we are adopting in California certainly have an impact on the cost of a gallon of gasoline or a gallon of diesel, whether it's the infrastructure bill, which was 12 cents a gallon, whether it's fuels under the cap and trade program. The Energy Commission's estimate is about 10 cents a gallon. The low carbon fuel standard's another, maybe five cents a gallon. So as these policies get adopted, we also have to keep in mind, what impact does that have on communities, and in some cases disadvantaged communities, where their proportional income is difficult to invest in transportation fuels. Meritorious as they are, the cost side has to be in that equation also.
John Hofmeister is a former president of Shell Oil, and he had something surprising to say recently when he was at Climate One about fossil fuel reserves that are on the books and reflected in the stock price of major oil companies.
I don't think they'll be burned. There's
and
too
what
much going
to the
on.
Share price of some of those companies that are built up.
They'll be flat. They'll be flat to down. But these companies won't go out of business. They'll change. They'll adapt.
Right.
They're full of smart people. There are more PhDs, more scientists in these companies working on, even ExxonMobil, a formidable competitor of my former company, is putting $500 million into biofuel, algae research.
While the time they were denying climate science, they were looking at ways they could benefit from a warming world by looking into the Arctic.
He was
nice,
nodding. He
Greg.
Said yes. Yeah. Slipped that in there. He agreed. You saw him. So there's the Exxon piece of that, what Exxon knew. But the first piece of that, Kathy Rehise-Boyd, was that's the former head of a major oil company saying that the assets already on the books reflected in the stock price of major oil companies will not be burned. Their stock prices will be flat to down.
So when one of the things that John said, and I know John well, one of the things that I really liked he said was the creativeness and the innovation of this industry. I've been with the industry for close to 30 years now, and they are some of the most creative, innovative people I have ever seen. The amount of research by these companies going into not only their liquid fuel side, but the future of alternatives and renewables is huge. It's actually more than the federal government or any other private entity. So they are thinking about the future and what that means to them as a company. And I can tell you, as a trade association, they're very different. They all have different views of how they look at that.
We have many, yeah, but they're also trying to slow down that future with their lobbyists in Washington and Sacramento.
Well, I mean, I think it's very important in any conversation about the energy mix that we are inclusive in that conversation. And I think we will be an important part of that conversation, not only in the past, but going forward. I mean, we were very supportive of the cap and trade extension. We were very involved in those conversations. So there is a desire to look at a shared vision for our sustainable energy future together. And I'm very proud that they're at the table in that conversation. And I think they want to be in, and they've invested a lot of time and energy in it.
And there's a lot of technology and talent in those companies. I think it's a question of how it's used.
Just to build on that, I think it's that transition to that clean energy economy, right? So planning for that, giving the companies the time to think about how they can stay within the energy business, but in a different way, and train their employees to do different things than they have in the past. The utility industry has had to do that, moving away from coal to natural gas to renewables, and it's a completely different mix of employees that you may need to run those types of facilities, giving them adequate time to train employees and have other employees that are going to retire. I mean, I think that's what we as a state have been able to do pretty effectively in setting long-term goals and then putting forward a path to try and achieve those.
Chief Scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovins, was here. He described how quickly things can change when it comes to transportation.
There are two pictures looking down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. In 1900, you have to look really hard to find the first car. In 1913, you have to look even harder to find what might be the last horse, and it's not at all clear that there's any horse left in that picture. 13 years to go from first car to last horse. And of course, the horse and buggy people thought they would have decades to adapt. You'd have to put in gas stations and traffic lights and all this infrastructure to replace their stables and such. But Henry Ford simply made the Model T 62% cheaper in 13 years, not quite the same period. And then it was all over when GM and DuPont invented something called car loans, which were used in 3/4 of the purchases that made U.S. household car ownership go from 8% to 80% in 10 years.
That's Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute. Andreas Klugeschardt with BMW. Smaller population, things are moving very fast these days. What do you think about the potential for a really quick transformation, quicker than even big smart companies like BMW might anticipate?
Well, you know, if you look into the things that are happening right now, and you think about the pace of change that we're already realizing here, you know. So it took us 3 years to sell the first 100,000 electric vehicles between 2013 and the end of 2016. Last year, we did another 100,000 within 1 year. And as I mentioned early on, 2018, we'll see probably around 140,000 electric and electrified, that is plug-in hybrids, also vehicles from BMW. So you see there is an acceleration in that topic. But the truth is also that, you know, it's not only about the car, the vehicle itself, but as you mentioned early on, it's the infrastructure side. And yes, Amory Lovins was referring to the fact, and you were referring to the fact that also for cars, you know, the filling stations, the traffic lights and so on and so on. But, you know, you need to think, when you think about the electric vehicle, you need to also think about the availability of infrastructure. You need to think the customer perspective that Kathy also mentioned. And so there are, this topic is a little bit more complex than just about what used to be the horse and then became the internal combustion engine car, now being the electric vehicle. So
huge systems, 100 years, we've got a lot invested in these systems. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to go to our lightning round, series of quick questions and quick answers for our guests, starting with association. I will mention a person, place, or thing, and our guests will say the first thing that pops into their head with unfiltered, regardless of what any their mother or teacher might think of that. So first with Andreas Klugeschardt, what comes to mind when I say Tesla?
Good to have them as competitor.
Kathy Rehise Boyd, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt.
Interesting.
Caroline Choi, beautiful, clean coal.
No such thing.
That was from the State of the Union speech. Kathy Rehise-Boyd, California Governor Jerry Brown.
Pragmatic.
Andreas Klugscheid, VW. I can't hear your eyes on radio.
Did I say beep?
Beep. Caroline Choi, peak oil.
When's it going to happen?
True or false? Kathy Rehise-Boyd, burning fossil fuels is a major cause of climate disruption.
A contributor.
True or false, Andreas Klugscheid, the notion of capturing carbon pollution from smokestacks and cramming it down a hole in the ground is totally bogus.
I would share that.
That's a yes. For Andreas Klugscheid, diesel cars produce less carbon pollution than gasoline cars.
That's true.
But they also produce more local pollutants that cause cancer.
Not necessarily.
Depends on the diesel. Kathy Rehise-Boyd, when your husband was CEO of the California Air Board, he directed the country's largest air pollution control program run by a state.
True.
So that means that your marriage is an example of an industry capturing its regulator.
He actually captured my heart, but, you know.
Good comeback. Her husband's a great guy who did run the air board in this state for a long time. Good comeback. That ends our lightning round. Let's give them a round for getting through the gauntlet.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about getting around without gasoline. Coming up, the promise of self-driving cars.
Autonomous driving actually will, to a large degree, bring down the issue of casualties in traffic.
That's up next when Climate One continues. You're listening to Climate One. We're talking about how technology is driving the movement towards cleaner cars and a healthier planet. Our guests are Kathryn Rehise-Boyd of the Western States Petroleum Association, Andreas Klugscheid of BMW, and Caroline Choi of Southern California Edison. Here's Greg Dalton.
Let's talk about technology. Kathy, you've talked about some breakthrough potential. There's actually something, that, you know, the possibility that sunlight could combine CO2 and water to make hydrocarbon. So either that or other things. What are some big tech breakthroughs that we can't solve this carbon equation without some big tech breakthroughs?
Yeah, and I think really recently, one of the things I'm very excited about, because I'm very, very look forward to unique partnerships on innovation. And we've used to work a lot with the national labs. We're blessed in this state with national labs.
And that's where this innovation is coming
out
of.
And this innovation has come. So then, whether it's Lawrence Berkeley or Lawrence Livermore National Lab, in this case, Lawrence Livermore, reached out and started to talk about some new innovations that they're doing as a national lab to capture carbon and get it out of the atmosphere and then put it to some beneficial use. One of the very innovative things they talked about, which I don't know much about, and I will more this week, is imagine taking carbon out of the atmosphere and turning it into a hydrocarbon.
Methane or ethylene
or some other component. And that was just something I had never even envisioned. But it's that kind of creative thinking that is going on not only in the automakers or the utilities or in our industry, but that place that academia can actually add so much innovation that they're working on, that how can we collaborate on those types of things as we go forward.
Andreas Klugscheid, how about in making cars? You know, the i3 has carbon fiber. Some people would say there's still a lot of room in the internal combustion engine, the Henry 100 years ago. Where are the big innovations, the technical breakthroughs that can get to a new auto industry?
Well, as I mentioned before, we are witnessing that right now here. You know, when you know,
I was in California in 2008, sitting in a BMW facility in Oxnard, where a guy came around and said, you know, I have this lithium ion battery and I think it could work well in a vehicle that is 10 years ago. You know, 10 years is 10 years. But as I mentioned before, we are doing now 140,000 of these cars per year, and obviously numbers rising. So there is a drastic change in the industry happening, and with that, in the attached industries, if you like, with the utilities and the fossil fuel producers, you know, it has big repercussions. And it means also that this transformation is in need to be managed, and that refers to the skills of our associates. That means that the infrastructure needs to grow and come up. That means that the customer needs to understand better what potential these technologies have. You know, one of the big issues actually to make the customer more aware, part of our obligations, but also part of everybody's obligations here, that you know, electric vehicles are a real alternative, right? For their driving needs.
And some people would say that the one little dirty secret of the auto industry is that companies make more money on after sales, service, et cetera, than actually the margins are quite thin on selling the car. It's, you know, it's the razor and razor blades. You know, you keep coming back, and that companies don't make as much money, Andreas Klugescheid, on electric cars. So the dealers don't like to sell them, promote them, because you're not going to come back for an oil change or transmission or spark plugs or all those things that get you go back. Is that true?
Well, first of all, I'm happy to report that a very well-known US NGO did some mystery shopping, and BMW turned out to be one of the few companies actually who made a very good impression in that respect, you know, willingness of dealers to actually sell electric vehicles, you know, consulting their customers and so on and so on. And I can support your statement that for the time being, we are actually having very low margins in specifically selling electric vehicles because the technology is still very expensive. But, you know, there is no way around it. And I can also assure you that BMW has clearly understood that the future of automobiles is going to be electric. There's no question about it.
You know, every electric car means that people are not filling up at the gasoline station. Caroline Choi, are oil companies trying to slow down you taking some of their revenue?
Well, it is not a significant portion of the revenue to date. We hope to take more and more of it. And
so I said we're in each other's swim lanes.
Yeah.
They're energy companies, and we are an electricity company. I think we are working together right now to advance where the state wants to head. But I, you know, over time, we hope that electricity does become the dominant fuel of vehicles in other parts of the economy. We want more electricity use in buildings and space and water heating, again, because we're going to have so much renewable, clean electricity powering the grid that you should plug into the grid for so many aspects of your lives to take advantage of that. And so as long as we can maintain the affordability of electricity, which is going to be critical, Kathy's right that energy is an important component of all of our customers' lives, and it's really important that it stay affordable. A third of our customers are on an income-qualified rate. It's very important that the price of electricity stays at a point where they don't have to make choices that are very difficult for them. But we do see that a cleaner and cleaner grid, the way that California's headed, is a great opportunity for customers and for Californians.
And I mean, that's why, Greg, when we were talking in the earlier session, the cost piece of that, to what Caroline is saying, is an important piece of this conversation, because we do have the highest electricity rates in California. It's very high. And so as we look at that transition going forward, or that energy mix going forward, the cost side is really important. And when you sort of peel the onion a little bit and you start looking at some of the projections from the Energy Information Administration, which is a federal entity of the Department of Energy, they look out into the future and they give us projections of what they see energy. And they're still projecting in 2040, 80% of energy will come from coal, gas, and oil. So when we talk about this time frame, it's really important to put that into perspective of, you know, how do we come together on an inclusive shared conversation with that kind of a statistic out there, given the infrastructure that we have and the changes that have to be made and the cost that's associated with it and what the consumers bear. So it is, as Andrea said, it's a complex conversation that it's great that all of us are in.
Well, and while we have some of the highest electricity rates in the country, we have some of the lowest bills because we do live in a place that doesn't need a lot of energy. Fortunately, we have a lot of places that don't have air conditioning and don't use our heating because the coastal communities. We do have more people moving inland, and so that is a concern, is how do we keep it affordable and have programs that make it affordable, including energy efficiency to try and minimize the use of electricity and make those homes and buildings as efficient as possible so they can minimize their electricity usage. I do think that transition is important, but California has shown that it is possible to move away from fossil fuels. You see it very aggressively in the policymaking space and in the implementation of these policies at the state level. And so if California can show it can be done, the sixth largest economy in the world, it can be done elsewhere too. It has to be done in a thoughtful way, in a way that does allow for that transition to take place so it's not as disruptive as it could be to the state's economies. But it is possible to do it, and I think it can be done faster than what EIA is reporting.
We're talking about the future of mobility at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. My guests are Caroline Choi with Edison International, Kathy Rehise-Boyd with the Western States Petroleum Association, and Andreas Klugescheid with BMW. Let's go to our audience questions. Welcome to Climate One.
Okay. I want to ask you about the agony and the ecstasy, which are two possible futures that might come about through this. And the agony is that I send my Beamer out to go get pizza in the evening, and it goes out, you know, autonomously, collects the pizza, comes back. And when I want to go to work, I sit in the back of my BMW for 2 hours working my presentation while my car drives me to work. And it takes 2 hours because there's like twice as many cars on the road, but nobody cares how long it takes, right? And when I get back home, we plug in my Beamer right at 5 o'clock when the sun is going down and the emissions are going up. And the ecstasy is kind of the opposite, is that you have everything shared and the cars charge according to your power forward algorithm. So when it's the least greenhouse gases and stuff like that, you get the picture. So what do you think the probabilities are of this agony thing and the ecstasy thing?
Thank you.
Can we do to shift the needle so it's more on the ecstatic side?
I don't know. I would put the pizza fetching in the ecstasy part.
That's pretty good to me.
Bad
pizza. Yeah.
I'd like to take ecstasy, actually, with all the connotations that it has. But anyway, you know, there's truth in both scenarios to some degree. One is, and that is a promise to our customers, that there will never be a BMW without a steering wheel, okay? So there's always going to be the option for you to drive your Beamer. But that aside, there's certainly the, you know, there might be a future when your car actually does the pizza trip. I'm sure that city regulators and many other people will have issues with that, you know, because it means more vehicle miles traveled, more congestion, more, you know, space that you need, and so on and so on. So that is not a political option, and it is really upon us here, also working together with universities like UC Davis and others, to figure out how that revolution is going to be managed in a way so that it is, you know, somewhat bearable and acceptable. The potentials that are out there are: autonomous driving actually will, to a large degree, maybe down to zero, bring down the issue of casualties in traffic. Mm-hmm. Now, the last time, I admit that is 2 or 3 years ago, I found for the U.S. like 30,000 plus casualties every year, death people in traffic. In Germany, it's around 2,500 to 3,000, so it's way lower. You know, we have only a fourth of your population, but still. Every single one is obviously one too many, one too much. And hence, that is one of the big promises of autonomous driving that is, you know, on the plus side. And the charging scenario that you described is actually happening already today. I mentioned earlier on the managed charging that really resulting in you can charge when the energy prices are the lowest. You can charge when the carbon footprint of your electricity is the lowest. You can charge whenever you need your car. So more on the ecstatic side, but bear in mind that autonomous driving, first and foremost, is really about saving human lives.
Next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi. Global oil prices are notoriously difficult to predict. And in fact, just a few years ago, prognosticators who thought we were entering the era of high global oil prices have shown to be very wrong. However, between OPEC dysfunction, Saudi political ambitions, and U.S. fracking coming online at about $55 to $65 a barrel, arguably we're entering an era of low global oil prices. Any commentary on what the global oil price regime might mean for electric vehicle penetration?
Caroline Choi, when oil prices go down, people go back to their SUVs that they love.
They do. It's unfortunate. I do think it takes a lot of effort to get people to switch to an electric vehicle. One of the things that the state has done most recently is create a new nonprofit called Veloce. You have a number of automakers, utilities, and other companies who are contributing to that to have a statewide marketing education campaign for people to be aware of the fact that there are these electric vehicles. And once you get into an electric vehicle, how many people have an electric vehicle? Once you get into an electric vehicle and it's smooth and it's quiet and it's fast, you don't want to actually go back into a gasoline vehicle. So it's just getting that awareness, getting people into those cars, ride and drive, those kinds of experiences to have people make that switch. But when gas prices are low, it is very difficult. And if there aren't enough options for people who like their SUVs, who need a big car, who have families, who are trucking stuff around, you've got to have the models available for those people to switch into the kinds of cars that they currently drive and that meets their needs. Those models are coming. I was at the LA Auto Show last year, and every year you see more vehicles, more model types coming out by automakers to meet the demands of customers because they do see that the future is electric, and they're bringing models that have electrification as part of their fleets.
Let's go to our last question. Welcome.
So I'm going to go back to the first speaker who talked about the agony and the ecstasy. And the ecstasy seems to be this discussion of the transformation and California's lead on that transformation away from fossil fuels. But the agony, for me, has been one of the things in the news lately, that Donald Trump has opened up offshore oil drilling. And that seems to be quite a contradiction. I would suggest that if the petroleum industry did not drill in the offshore openings of that, it would be irrelevant. I'm wondering if you can respond to what the lobbyists in regards to the petroleum industry have been involved with, and what your position is on that offshore oil drilling.
Thank you for the question. And I would say for California, and really the Pacific West, Oregon, Washington, California, we're probably under the most stringent environmental regulations probably in the world. And the only thing I'd ask you in that question to think about is when we have to supply the amount of transportation fuels every day that requires people to move from A to B and heat and cool their homes or turn their lights on, that it takes crude oil to do that and to turn it into those valuable products. It has to come from somewhere to make 38 million, 39 million people in California able to move tomorrow or move goods and services out of the ports. That still has to happen. And if it's not going to be offshore and it's not going to be in our own backyard and it's not going to be crude by rail, it means we're going to transport it in on marine tankers from parts of the world that don't particularly appreciate our desire to be energy independent.
We have to wrap it up. I'm going to ask each guest, your vision or hope for the future. What gives you hope, Andreas, that we're going to meet this mathematical challenge to make this major transformation in time before there's more Houstons and Miamis?
Well, what gives me hope and to some degree also ecstasy is really that there's so much potential in there, and I stick to that idea of convergence of the energy transition and the transport system transition. This is really where the fun starts, where there are new business cases. And new business cases mean that we will have a rapid development in the right direction, but we need to do it together. That is super important. This is not about finger pointing. The customer needs to be integrated, the regulator, the policymaker, the industry, and also the energy colleagues. Let it be utilities or let it be fossil.
Caroline Choi, your pep ending for how we're going to get it done.
You know, I think this transformation is already underway, and the innovation that's coming, that's out there and that's coming, is really fantastic. And so I'm not worried about that we can't do it. It's just a matter of getting more people to know about the options and adopt those vehicles. So in the financial innovation that's happening, the technological innovation that's happening, both at private companies as well as in academia and in the industry, it's really fascinating. I do agree with Andreas, it's working together because the policies really have to come together and be integrated both at the state and local level and at the federal level if possible. But California can do it on its own in many, many ways, and it's doing that, it's demonstrating that. And so it's just getting out there, all you people with electric vehicles, and preaching to the choir of getting more people in those vehicles, because it's a tremendous opportunity. I don't think we should let it go by.
So, Kathy Boyd, tell us how we're going to get it done and how your members are going to make tons of money on clean energy.
I really think it's a transition of our mindset, because I do believe that if we answer those core questions together, we will get to the right shared energy future. And that is affordable, reliable energy to the most people possible. It is making sure we meet our environmental goals, whether they're air quality or climate change. And it is the economic side of that equation, so there's upward mobility for communities and people that rely on this energy mix. And then in the end, that we've all talked together about how are we going to balance those so we can go forward. So I think it's a transition of all of our mindsets together.
You've been listening to a Climate One conversation on the future of the automobile with Greg Dalton. Greg's guests were Caroline Choi, Senior Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at Southern California Edison, Kathy Rehise Boyd, President of the Western States Petroleum Association, and Andreas Klugescheid, Head of External Affairs for the BMW Group. To hear all our Climate One conversations, subscribe to our podcast at our website, climateone.org, where you'll also find photos, video clips, and more. If you like the program, please let us know by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next time for another conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment.
Climate One is a project of the Commonwealth Club of California. Kelly Pennington directs our audience engagement. Carlos Manuel and Tyler Reed are producers. The audio engineer is Mark Kirshner. Annie Chelsea and Devin Strolovich edit the show. The Commonwealth Club CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Climate One is produced in association with KQED Public Radio.